Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Coffee with Friends. Today, we're having coffee with Maria, who wrote a book about being the child of George Peters. Before we get started, though, this live stream, we discuss trauma of all sorts to include all types of abuse. Viewers and listeners may find it unsettling and triggering. If this live stream causes you distress, please seek support from your trusted folks and qualified mental health professionals as needed. You may also cease listening until you're able to listen again. The guests on our live streams reflect a diverse set of values, morals, and ethics that may not reflect the morals, values, and ethics of the Misfit Amish. With that being said, I'd like to welcome Maria Moore. Good morning.
Good morning, Erin. I'm good. I'm excited to be here and finally meet you in person.
Well,
I've been following virtual. You for some time after reading your book and online. Okay. Yep.
Well, I actually read your book, you know, called Not My Kind of Mennonite. And it struck me as particularly interesting, your title.
Yeah, and that's, it does have a story. I had my career as a registered nurse, and I was working with a colleague, and she was telling me a bit about her background. So she said that she was a Mennonite, and that she was a Swiss Mennonite, and she made that distinction very clear. And so I listened to her talk about her childhood and where she grew up, and she certainly doesn't, you know, dress as a Mennonite or live her life in a simple way. She's a more advanced or, you know, less conservative Mennonite. So when she was finished, I said that I was a Mennonite too. I said, I was Mexican Mennonite. I was born in Mexico. And she stopped and she kind of put her nose up in the air and she says, well, you're not my kind of Mennonite. And I thought, oh, that was a little harsh. And so I went home and I wrote that in my little book of journal, and I do. And I thought, there's going to be a time where that comes in handy.
You know, so if you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself, I usually like to give the audience kind of a little background, you know, brief, like 30 seconds of who you are. But I think you already touched about, like, you were a Mexico Mennonite and you were RN. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
So no, I was born in Mexico. So were my parents. So I am a second generation Mexican. And due to, well, when I get into my book, The Murder of Father, I was put up for adoption after his death and my mother's inability to care for us. So I abruptly left the Ocali Mennonite faith when I was about 9 years old. And probably in my life, it's been a journey to fill in all the blanks and sort of address the memories that popped up in my head because I had no one to talk to about my life beforehand. And yes, I was privileged enough to be adopted into a family that allowed me to go to college, and I became a registered nurse, which I've done now for 40 years. And through that work, it has really helped me get a better understanding of too, how the trauma affected my life and how I was able to overcome some obstacles and others can't.
Mm-hmm. Because some things you get through and some mm-hmm. things you heal from. So some of those things are different for different people because trauma affects everybody differently, but also trauma is anything that overwhelms the central nervous system. It's too much, too soon, and too fast. And so because we're all unique human beings, we all tend to like respond differently to different stimuli. But in the same token, if we've experienced repetitive trauma or trauma during development, that also affects you differently because it can arrest development. Is that right?
Absolutely. I was adopted. I had been subjected to sexual trafficking by my Mennonite mother. And when I was adopted, the Children's Society coached my parents to simply never speak of the past again. That was the advice that they were given. So anyone that's been through trauma knows that that's easier said than done, because in comes the nightmares and the simple little triggers that you don't really understand as a child because you don't know why. You know, you're always you can judge someone from across a room to know if you should trust them and what danger they might bring to you at an early stage. And those were always things that I worked with. And I formed my opinions early on people because of my history of abuse. And so my parents struggled with that because when they adopted me, they also adopted my two younger biological brothers. So we came with a lot of baggage and they had no idea how to manage that baggage. So their life was very challenging in trying to raise us and meet our needs when we weren't supposed to talk about anything. And of course, at 9, I knew that my mother was still alive and I had other siblings. And now I'm not able to talk about them either. It was supposed to just start fresh. And my parents had no other children. So we weren't for them, certainly. But, you know, we came with a lot of stuff.
Well, just thinking about, like, what the silencing does. Because typically the best outcomes for children is to provide them trauma-informed care, and that includes trauma-informed counseling from actually qualified people, right? Like, typically that's what we know now. Maybe they didn't know that back then because this happened in, like, the 60s, like, right?
Yeah, we were adopted in 73. And so even okay. In 73, during the process of you know, us going into foster care, waiting to see what my father's trial would show and those kind of things, his criminal trial, there was no one ever asked me if I was abused. Not one person ever asked what our background was. And, you know, reflecting now, I'm not sure if I would have been able to name it because it was such a normal part of the way that my sister and I were raised that I don't know that I saw it as being abnormal, or in some cases I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have had the language to describe what happened. So it was never brought up, but at the same time I don't know if they would have asked me if I was abused if I would have said yes or not, because I didn't know anything different.
But you also should have had the opportunity at least. And when you say yes. The language, did you speak a different primary language?
Yes, I spoke Plaritch. And then when I was put into foster care, there was a few years of foster care after my parents came to Canada, I picked up a bit of English. So when adopted was the first time my language was entirely English. And I had to prepare for school, which was also the first time that I was allowed to go to school, which was when I was 9. It was a big transition.
I just had to ask because, like, I know that, like, I grew up speaking Dutch, like, we called it Dutch, Pennsylvania German, or, you know, people call it Pennsylvania Dutch, but it's not really that. It's just, it's something, right? It's our own dialect of, like, German that has evolved over the last couple hundred years. And is there an origin story like that to the language, like, Platt speech?
Yeah, it's exactly like yours, where it's kind of a dialect that the sort of the Russian impression Mennonites made when they were traveling in the 1800s. You know, as my former colleague had said, she was a Swiss Mennonite, so they sort of went the Swiss way, and my family broke away into another colony, went to Russia and Prussia, which is now Ukraine. And in that transition, it was a Low German sort of dialect mixed with Dutch that they did to sort of come up with their own way of speaking to each other in their congregation so that potentially others wouldn't understand what they were saying, but it also identified them as being that culture. So even when I started research for my book, I would meet some older relatives who challenged me to speak Plaritch in order for me to get the history, because that would prove that I was family. And because of my long time, you know, the time of not speaking it, I couldn't speak it. It's certainly a very familiar language to me. And I always warn my own children and husband, you know, they always say when you get dementia, you revert to your first language. So I said, oh gosh, everyone's going to be in trouble when I start speech because no one's going to understand anything I'm saying. Hopefully it won't get that way.
Yeah. I mean, that is true about when you get dementia, by the way. Like, yeah. I worked in a long-term care facility way back when with Alzheimer's and dementia patients. And yes, people do revert to their first language.
Yeah. We're all in trouble then.
We're all in trouble. We're just gonna have, like, you know, we're gonna be all right though, because they're gonna at least, like, you know, make sure that we eat and have a nice, warm, safe place to stay, hopefully. Hopefully. That's my dream, right? Yeah, I'm gonna be okay. Right. So why write your book after all these years?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So as I said, I was adopted when I was 9, and I basically had to leave my culture, my faith, I knew to be normal, behind and start fresh. And that was encouraged by, you know, my new family and my new set of relatives that I should just begin fresh. But when you know that you have other family and there's missing family members, my sister and I had always been very close, and now, like, I don't really know where she is. And so I started researching, probably in my teens, more actively. I'd go into the library and finding phone books from the area where I knew I lived, and cold calling people and just saying, you have the same last name that my mother had. Do you think we're cousins? You know, and occasionally you'd find someone that spoke English. And through that work, I gradually found people that I could say that, oh yes, our mothers are sisters. And then I started researching a bit more, trying to understand what happened on the night that I witnessed my father being killed. And so it started to then, with going through archives and looking through all the newspaper articles that were written about his murder. And then through that, I got a whole bunch of other names and trying to piece together, like, who were the people that were important there and who, you know, were the people that could give me a better history of what was going on. And then I got more information, and I was able to find out where my mother was. And that was in my 20s. And it was important to me to find her before I decided to have my own children, because I knew that she suffered from significant mental health problems and addictions. And then as a nurse, I was afraid of if I had children, would they end up the same? Like, where was I starting a life for my children that would have been the same sort of demise as my mother? So when I found her, she was actually homeless on the streets in this Windsor, which is a city a few hours from me, and very untreated, schizophrenic. And so it was extremely unsatisfying. She had no idea who I was. She only remembered my oldest as being her child. And so it didn't give me the answers I needed. So I kept digging again. And I found my uncle, who was responsible for the shooting of my father. And I actually went to see him as well, because I needed some clarity. And not to give away everything in my book, but my uncle, when I went to visit him many years later as an adult, he refused to speak English to me. He only spoke Pladich when I went to his house. And his wife was there and a few children, and the children could speak English. And he just cried the entire time and didn't answer any questions for me, didn't communicate anything. And I guess my point of going there was that I just needed to see him. I needed to know what kind of a man he was. Because from what I had read in the newspapers and my faint memories as a child, I didn't place him in a very high regard. So again, there was more unanswered questions. So it was a perpetual research. And I graduated from university later in my nursing career. And so I started doing some online research into universities that studied Mennonite history. And there's so many. There's so many experts in Mennonites and history, as we talked about before we went online here. So I thought, well, I should read some books and figure out what I can learn about my family and the old colony Mennonites.
Yeah.
And what I had learned then is that, you know, despite being a Mexican Mennonite, which is sometimes frowned upon because we're potentially not as traditional or as good as another kind of Mennonite, is that we started in Manitoba. My family, my grandparents immigrated in the late 1800s to Canada from Russia, and were offered land. And when the Canadian government started putting pressure on the Mennonites that they needed to integrate to English school, there was a small group of Mennonites that kind of broke away from the colony or sister colony, which happens, I think, in a lot of, I'm not sure if it happens in Amish, but it certainly happens in Mennonites all the time. If there's an elder that decides, you know, I don't approve of this, or the way the women get their hair, or the way we're integrating into society, I'll start my own little church. And so they had a little breakaway, And so my grandparents jumped on that bandwagon and they decided that they were going to leave because they didn't want to teach their children English and put English in the schools. They wanted to stick to traditional German and keep their culture. So at that time, a few scouts went out to find land, and northern Mexico was something that came up as an opportunity for them. So in the 1920s, they got, I think, 8 trains. And in Canada, they loaded every family that wanted to go, which was 7,000. Old colony men decided that, you know, making sure that they lived their most truest faith and sticking to the words of, you know, what they believed was the ultra religious group, they decided that they would leave their Mennonite brothers and sisters behind and start their own colony and follow the words of their elders, which would be to replicate something closer to what was in Russia. So everybody got on a train, and it took about 6 days. And from Manitoba, they took the train to Mexico. And it was a lot of Manitoba colony Mennonites, as well as Saskatchewan, Swift Current. And they settled in northern Mexico. And they set up their colony there, just exactly the same as it would have been in Russia, the same street layouts. They brought some of the same sermons, because, of course, ministers don't have formal training. It's just those men, of course, that seem to be able to lead. So they followed the same sermons that were set in Russia. And they wanted to replicate what the purified sort of Mennonite colony should look like in northern Mexico.
I have a question, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
Earlier you said, did you say the fake memories that you had?
Yeah. And I think, and it was more of a fear, because the last year before I was put up for adoption, I lived full time with a Mennonite household, which I don't talk a whole lot about the book, but Mennonite foster care was very strict because they had an obligation to pretty well everything my parents had done wrong in the time that I was there. So it was a very strict Bible reading, memorizing of Bible verses and reciting them, learning like how to cook and clean. And so that sort of 1 year of very focused religious pressure left me with several years of probably trauma related to that, because I recall like falling asleep from exhaustion and being woken up to repeat again a Bible, and that I would recite it at church. And I think, you know, in reflection, that was probably to prove that, you know, the work with this Mennonite family was actually making me into a good Mennonite, where my parents had held in the past. And that sort of pressure stayed with me. And when I was adopted, we went to church, but it was a United church. Mm-hmm. So it was very liberal. And there was not near as much pressure. But what I found to be the same is that it really mattered what you wore and how you acted. And there was a lot of comparison that still went on within the church, because my mother loved having a daughter. I was dressed beautifully and my hair was like perfect. And in the Mennonite church, it's you want to be clean. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. So it was always a struggle to go from that sort of be in the corner, don't make a fuss. And from a trauma background, you don't want to draw attention to yourself, because who knows what's going to happen next. So then now I'm going to a church where everyone's like, so these are the new kids. Wow, that's nice. And people will comment on my appearance all the time, which is extremely uncomfortable, because my whole goal was to be invisible. And that was where that sort of church trauma came in that followed me, because too much attention was given, not to the Bible as much at this church, but how you looked and what you wore and how you fit into society.
It's like, you know, if you're dressed appropriately, that's going to make you holier and closer to Jesus. But am I understanding you right that you were placed in foster care before your father died? And it was Mennonite foster care. Some of it was Mennonite foster care. And that was like this foster care, like they taught you, they told you about your parents, but it wasn't necessarily true what they were telling you about your parents.
By that time, yes, because when my parents came to Ontario, they didn't have the resources, whether that be financial or educational, to understand how to integrate into an English culture and the school system. So we weren't going to school, certainly. So then when my mother with her mental health would disappear for a few days and my father would disappear, the neighbors would call and say, you know, there's six kids over there that don't have any adults at home looking after them or feeding them. So then Children's Aid would come in and split us up and send us to foster homes. So some of them, at other times, they were not Mennonite, which would also be a big shift. And I relate back to my sort of striving for education, the same as in your book, Mary, where you know that there's something better out there. So I would have a little taste of going to school in a non-Mennonite foster home. And I would go to school for whatever length of time, 2-3 months, till my parents showed up and they were determined to be fit again. And so when I would come back, I would always know that there was something better. And I think that always was my drive, that somewhere there's something better than what I'm living, you know. And that would be school. That would be like, there's better things out there. Like, we don't have to starve. We don't have to be subjected to this abuse. And even as a small child, the thing I had in my head that there's got to be something better than this. And in my book, I talk about me, you know, trying to dress and get ready for the bus on my own with no food or parent at home, trying to go to school because I thought, oh my gosh, if I could just go to school, there would be a routine there and a ritual and people might see me as being the same as them and not abnormal. Of course, I went to school in my pajamas, because those are the only clean clothes that I had. And then I got them from a foster home. So some people that read the book are always traumatized by that chapter. But for me, it was just like something I was so proud of, because I had the wherewithal to sort of get up. And even if it was, you know, 4 hours before the bus, I was waiting outside till it came so I wouldn't miss it. Dressed in my pajamas with no lunch. And so I think that the drive started then in just understanding that, you know, the judgment on my parents didn't have to influence my life. But through my years of research and certainly talking to Mennonite people, I realized the pressures they were under, and I was able to sort of step back and take a better look at how they lived. And that's part of the research in my book.
Which is kind of like this thing of sometimes we come from groups of people that perhaps hold some values or even many values, or sometimes beliefs about how to raise children that can result in harm being covered up and hidden when it is perpetrated towards anybody, really. And for you, that chapter that you mentioned with the education and going to school, that really stuck out to me. Like, you were just like, I'm gonna go to school. I know there's more out there. I know we don't have to struggle. I know we don't have to always look for the next, you know, wonder where our next meal is gonna come from or where we're gonna sleep next, you know? Even as a child, sometimes, even when we're inside of insular groups, sometimes we can see things that give us hope. And I think the things that keep us alive are the things that give us hope. Would you agree with that? Like, they keep us
absolutely. Because I think at the time I was being sexually abused by various people around the area. And, you know, as a child, you can block that away. You can put that in the back of your head and you just think, so tomorrow I'm going to school and I'm going to do something different from that. And I have to have something different. And when we talk about, you know, disciplining of children, certainly as in a closed community like that, you do live in fear. And my mother wasn't a good disciplinarian and my father wasn't around. So we were kind of let to run wild. So I think then the extra pressure came when we went to foster care, that somebody had to discipline us. And that involves straps and belts and, you know, waking you from sleep to recite Bible verses again and again to make sure that you knew your place. And those kind of things, again, you just put in the back of your head, because that was like, they did the same not as harshly with Sis because she couldn't read and she had an intellectual disability, but we were, you know, tried to be groomed to be good Mennonite women, which is to know our place, to know the Bible, and then to know how to cook and clean from a very young age. But it was when I started interviewing my living relatives, like my mother's sisters, that I realized that all of them knew that we were being sexually trafficked. They knew that there was danger to us. They knew what my mother was doing, but no one wanted to interfere. And they would actually bring that up when I went to see them. Oh, it's really awful what happened to your sister. You know, how your mom let that happen to her. But what, you know, in reflection, I've come to decide is that how does a Mennonite woman in Northern Mexico learn how to sexually traffic her children? There's no outdoor influences to allow that in, except the fact that she was probably also sexually trafficked. And that was just part of her life. And it would come up occasionally when I had gotten to know my mother again after adoption and before her death, where she would tell me some of the stories about what it was like in her childhood, about the rapes from family and in the colony, not feeling safe. And so it was such a cover up for so many generations that when she did those things for my sister and I don't believe she would have known any better. And it took me many years to figure out that my mom functioned at about a grade 2 and 3 level. She was had a lot of intellectual problems. There was no reasoning capabilities. She couldn't read or write. She could sign her name, which was on a few legal documents. But here was a woman that was subjected to sexual abuse and rape within the colony by her own siblings and by other people within the colony based on her only value was simply that she could bear children, which was made very clear to her at a young age because she couldn't read or write. She didn't need to go to school as long as she could bear children, which was what her role was. So you give a woman that functions with that low of an intellectual IQ and coping skills and generational trauma, 8 children to raise.
Well, and I just have a question. Do you think it's by design? Because, you know, obviously, like you're capable, right? Like you went to school, you became an RN. Like, do you think it's by design if we keep the women intellectually like unaware, or if we keep people from information or access to education as children, is it by design to keep them subjugated?
Well, I think it plays a big part, certainly, because when I started finding family members and reintroducing myself to them, they would remember me as a child. And I would say that I'm a nurse now. And they said, so, but are you married? Like, do you have children? That should be your priority.
Right.
And I believed I could have both. And they're like, well, do you send most of your money to the church then? Like, what are you doing with your money? And that was the next question. I was like, okay, so I never ever said I was a Mennonite church nor, but it was just presumed, therefore, if I was a woman working outside the house, that they would have to be payback and I would have to be giving my money to the church and making sure my duties were done.
So it's not necessarily that people in old colony, and I want to make this point if I'm right in this, and you tell me if I'm not, it's not necessarily that people in old colony Mennonite communities are cognitively impaired or intellectually impaired. Some of them might be, but it's also a lack of access to information. When you control access to information, when you control the education system, you control an entire group of people. Is that correct?
That's correct. I found many relatives that were very intellectually, you know, brilliant. I had a cousin who whose family was so poor that they couldn't afford to send them to Mennonite because it cost so much a month to pay the teacher. So when they were living in Mexico, the family decided to send their kids to Mexican school. It was free. And those women are brilliant. They can speak 4 languages and they know math. They know chemistry. They know about the history of Mexico. They know about the country that they're living in, where other people that you know, had the money to go to Mennonite school, learned how to read the Bible. And that's where it ended, because no other education was needed. It didn't matter about where you were residing or where you were living or how you might impact the community around you. It was all about controlling what was given to the women in school. And that certainly left them on the outside or almost shunned because of the amount of education they had received going to public school in Mexico.
My goodness. Thank you. Good morning, Daniel. And good morning, Hinda. Welcome. But no, thank you for that, because like I want people to understand that and what I'm hearing from you and what I was hearing from you was that. So thank you. When you were adapting to the world outside of the Mennonites, like, yes, you did all of this research, but when you were adapting to the world outside of the Mennonites, is there one thing that stuck out to you beyond the Bible teaching and the language barriers? Was there anything else? What the way of dress, anything else?
The way of dress was hard for me because my mom adopted me because, they didn't have any children. She really wanted a daughter. So the first thing I still have hair trauma because as a Mennonite girl, you don't cut your hair and you don't really have a lot of say in how your hair is kept or braided. So now I have a woman telling me, let's just put some highlights in there and give you a bit of a curly perm, you know, and it's just like, seriously, you know,
and so this is what,
yeah, well, because, you know, it's just a different culture. So like you got the Tony curly perm going on. And my mom really loved that I would look nice dressed up. So I was very uncomfortable looking nice. And it bothered me. And I think that was because, you know, as a child and certainly living in Ontario, if a man looked at you in a way that was, you know, flattering as a child, that meant that he wanted something more from you than simply, uh-huh, isn't she a cute little girl? Uh-huh. And that struck fear in me. So there was a lot of fear around my clothing and around the way I was meant to look in public. Then I got my ears pierced. It was like a just deep dive immersion into a culture that left me anxious. And then trying to like integrate into the school system. And that was another big thing for me because I had quite an accent and my sentences were very broken because of my new language of English. And my principal kept me in at every recess and sat with me with a ruler on a desk trying to teach me how to talk properly so that I would fit into an Ontario school and not be stigmatized of my background. So I didn't have as much opportunity to make friends in those early years in school because I was being reprogrammed to be a good Canadian English speaking girl. And that again was another level of change for me. But I think the church to me always was a place of fear and too much pressure. Like it never felt like a welcoming place, whether it was a Mennonite church or a United church, because it was all about how you looked and how you presented yourself in the community and the sort of level of stature you held within the church, depending on how committed your parents were to doing things. And it always left me with anxiety. I ended up being the pianist for the church. I played and piano. We sang all the hymns, but it felt like a competition. It wasn't a relaxing, welcoming place for me.
There was a lot of pressure.
And that probably is still true today. My children, I never took them to church. It was important that they knew what the Bible was in case it came up in conversation. But it wasn't something that I drilled into their heads. It's just like, you should know about the ark, you know, and, you know, Moses and a few of these things in case it comes up. But it's up to you to define what religion is and spirituality to you. And that was something that I made very clear when I had my own children.
That's really interesting because I'm kind of the same kind of parent. Like I raised my child that way. They know what the Bible is. They know some of the stories, but it's not my place to decide or dictate. Like if my child wants to go to church, I'll take them to church. If they don't want to go to church, yeah, okay. Like,
and my book too, I made a very conscious effort to not ever put down the Mennonite faith or criticize it because it was it was my culture. It was what my ancestors believed in for hundreds of years. But what I was hoping when I wrote my book is that women would see that you can have faith, but you can also stand up for yourself and not be abused by using faith as a weapon, that you can use it to enhance lives and not tear down women, especially, and some men for the abuse that they endured in these religious groups, that it's okay to have a little faith, but 100%, you need to be able to be autonomous to live your life the way you are, and that the church doesn't control every breath you take.
Or every stitch you make.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really important. I think one of the big things that's standing out to me here is like the parallels, like how similar and familiar some of what you're talking about feels. But it's also a little different because it is definitely a Mennonite story. And I wanted to thank you for that. That is important. But when you start talking about theology and faith, even some of the basic theology, like I know there's many Mennonites that evangelize. Like, do Old Colony Mennonites evangelize? Do you know?
I don't know for sure, because any Old Colony Mennonite I found that was my relative no longer is an Old Colony Mennonite. They switched religious. I don't know anyone that continues to go to the same church. And if they still go to Mennonite church, it is not nearly as conservative as the Old Colony, where they have more decision in the way they dress and the number of children they have. So even like direct family members are Lutheran. You know, they changed from the church. They got divorced, you know, because of years of abuse. And so they're more progressive. But any Mennonites I see that are on TikTok and on Instagram that still describe themselves as Old Colony are dressing in the same clothes, but they're live streaming. So I think that there's been a big shift in what conservative actually looks like for a lot of Mennonites.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered because of like for us, like I was taught, we heard this preached. Okay, this was preached, and I would say preach from the pulpit, except we didn't have a pulpit. Like we had church in our homes. That's right. Where we had church. So
yeah.
So like we would hear this preached. That you know, there's people in the world who have hope of going to heaven. But for us, like it would be wrong for us to go out in the world because of we were born Amish and that was a gift that was given to us. This is our gift. But we don't get to decide that the whole world is wrong and going to hell per se. It's our job to show by our dress, by our way of life, by who we are as people.
I think that it is within my Mennonite family because they had to do some level of integration. But even when I think back to some of the stories I learned about how they integrated with Mexico and the Mexicans around their colonies, they were always a far lower grade of a person than the Mennonite would be. Mm-hmm. And that even now I have cousins that live in northern Mexico that will say the Mennonites will like not pay them fair wages, the Mexicans, because they think that they're not nearly as good as the Mennonites will ever be. And so I tend to think that that's still something that's drilled into them at church and in their culture, is that somehow better than others because they are Mennonite and because of that background. But here in Ontario, Mexican Mennonites or Old Colony Mennonites that went to Mexico, I looked at in a less favorable lens because of some of the court cases that come up. And in Manitoba, especially, there's been several court cases where women and have come forward about the amount of sexual abuse within their families. And they've had the courage, because of their integration into society, to reach out to, you know, qualified people to support them to make the charges and to make sure some of the abuse stops. And that's as my family were from the Manitoba colony that went to Mexico. In Ryan Tase's book, women talking. Those were Manitoba Colony Mennonites that went to Paris. Is that they want less government control and less eyes, certainly on their colony and what the elders are doing within the church. So they go further south. They're in like literally tropical jungles setting up Mennonite colonies, trying to keep government and other Mennonites away from what they're doing. And in that book, it's a lot of those surnames, as you know, with Amish, like some of the surnames are all common, like there's Peters, there's Enns, there's Weeds. Those are all my family names. And those are all the names of the men that were charged with raping their siblings in Paraguay and went to prison. And so the abuse can still be covered, but sometimes there's some courage there that lets women come out and men, because certainly it's just not women that are abused. And it's finding ways when they can integrate into society, and then there's a safe place to go get the help is important, because they become so isolated that, you know, the only one that you can talk to as a counselor is, you know, the minister's wife. And she's just going to tell you that, I know you were raped, but maybe you need to forgive. And if you were a really good Christian, you would be able to forgive that and move forward, as opposed to just bearing the brunt of that. And you should never speak of this again, because that just proves that you're not a good Christian, because you haven't got forgiveness in your heart. And that's something that came up certainly in my interviews with family members about how can you forgive this? Like, we should talk about it, because we should have forgiven this by now. And I wasn't sexually abused totally by Mennonite men. It was the general public. So for me, it wasn't a total Mennonite sexual abuse situation. From Mennonite men within the colony.
But when you talk about the book, Women Talking, do you have any idea how actually Old Colony Mennonite women and survivors feel about that book or the movie?
I think the dialogue is very important in that movie, but the setting is probably not realistic. It would be hard for a group of women to get together and plan all those things without a man wondering where they were, certainly in that high control society. And the protection of children, women, I've not run into a lot of women that are Mennonite or even ex-Mennonite that are supportive of other women. It's kind of self-preservation. And I think that comes from years of trauma that they have. Even when I met relatives of my mother and I said, oh, my mother's died and I'm going to bury her. And they're just like, well, just give her to me. She deserves to be in the trash bin for the way she carried on. We'll just throw her in the garbage. She doesn't deserve a safe resting space. She deserves just to be thrown out. And that is women who knew that she was sexually abused and that she was beaten and that she had an intellectual disability, but it didn't matter. And I think if I consider back and, you know, not judge them, because it would be simply to say that it's self-preservation, that, you know, they had to have their own burdens to bear, and they were all abused, I think, to some extent. But it's the weak ones that bring it up.
You mentioned forgiveness and never speaking of it again. May I ask if your definition of forgiveness from the minister's wife was supposed to be never to speak of it again? Am I understanding that correctly?
Right.
You
might have shared that intimate detail with someone, that it would stop there, and that you are the one who will be shamed because you have brought it up. It's victim shaming as opposed to victim support.
Yes. And then the other part that you mentioned where, you know, women, it's not realistic. Like, so from what I'm understanding and hearing is, like, often inside of high control groups like that and insular isolated groups like that, what I've heard from so many survivors of so many different groups is it all kind of like parallels is, like, people are indoctrinated from childhood, from birth, even. When you consider the very young age at which some of these groups start disciplining babies, and even consistently teaching them, this is your role in life. They tell you where to go, what to wear, who to talk to, who's a good person. You learn very quickly who inside of these groups has more privilege than other people, right? Like you mentioned earlier, is like the old colony Mennonites in Manitoba. Is that right? They had less.
You cut out a little bit there for that last question. So could you repeat it for me?
Sorry. Oh, I was saying, like you mentioned a little bit ago about old colony Mennonites in Manitoba, they had a lesser status within, like they were seen as lesser than within the groups in Canada because of the abuse.
And I think the abuse had to do something with it, but be so ultra conservative. And they believed that because they were ultra conservative, somehow they were. And that comes out in some of the research that I read too, because a lot of the, I belong to some online Mennonite forums on Facebook. We see that, you know, like no one really understands why they went there and did what they did when they could have stayed here, you know, and integrated and went and sent their kids to school. And so there is a lot of judgment of that colony itself. And I don't know, because in the online forums and certainly in public literature, there isn't a lot of talk about the abuse that went on. And when it does come up in the news, there's nothing but denial. It must be exaggerated. That how would you believe that? Because that's too horrific to believe. And I think like with Miriam's book, sort of exposing some of these things, and then an actual court case where these men went to jail, there's still people who don't believe it to be true, that it was fabricated, that these women were the problem, that they came forward and said these things, when it's the men that hold the colony together, and they shouldn't have done that to the men, despite them raping their children.
Oh my. But it also goes right back to that whole thing that you were touching on, where so you have that overall control, and you have these people who are considered lesser than, there's a lot of judgment. And then when you have that type of structure and hierarchy within a patriarchal group that is pretty high control from the sounds of it, you often have women as the enforcers. Women police other women, and sometimes even other men, depending on their status and privilege within the community, within the group.
Yeah.
Women sit there and they are the enforcers, because proximity to power grants them the ability to do so. And sometimes it's because of survival. Sometimes it's for various reasons. I don't think it's just one reason at all. I think it's more nuanced than that.
I think you're absolutely right. You summed that up really well, Mary, because it doesn't seem like in my research or interviewing family members that everyone was in it together. You know, my mom was very low on the rung because she had an intellectual disability. She knew what her role was, and she just needed to shut up and serve.
Oh my.
That role, whether that was through, you know, just bearing children, but she shouldn't have had sort of the mental health issues that she had that would draw more than she was sort of seen to deserve within the colony.
Oh,
but it is. Yeah.
Yeah. We do have a question. How is the abuse handled when the perpetrator is someone outside the colony? Is it handled differently than if the offender was a Mennonite? Or do you know?
And I would think that if the offender was a Mennonite, you would take that first to your church, and you would tell your minister, your elders, that this abuse was going on. And then the elders might meet with this man or this woman and decide, you know, what sort of punishment they would have within the colony's walls. And that might be that they say they're sorry. That might be that, you know, they do something that the clergy or the leadership within the colony has decided. Now, if it's someone from outside, for myself, I was a Mennonite when I was abused, and it was people outside that certainly were coming in and abusing my sister and I. But I don't believe that as a Mennonite woman, my mom saw that there was anything wrong with that. And no one ever questioned me because they didn't know to ask those questions. But I would think there's a chance of getting police involved and having some actual, you know, accountability for the actions if it wasn't within the colony. It takes a lot to get these charges outside of a colony. For those women in the Manitoba colony, yes, in Paraguay, yes, it took a lot for them and a lot of courage to.
Oh, you sound like a zombie.
Colony.
It took a, okay, the last I heard was it took a lot. And then you sounded like a zombie.
Okay. It took a lot for those women to be able to seek outside help in getting charges against the men in their colony. But I don't know if those women would ever be seen the same or accepted because they risked the men and the reputation of the colony to serve their own need, even if it was just to protect their own children and their own lives.
Right. So
the colony is ahead of everybody.
Colony is ahead of everybody.
Yeah. Protecting the colony, its reputation, and the rules within it.
I do want to make one distinction. Like, I want to say this, like, just because the church would take it, like, here's the thing. People who are Anabaptists, plain Anabaptists, people who are part of high control groups like that, they're still citizens of whatever country they're in. Mm-hmm. And especially in America, I don't know how it is exactly in Mexico or even Canada, but in America, they are American citizens and they are still subject to the law. And if you know that somebody is being abused or you suspect a child is being abused, there are child helplines across the entire 50 states of America. You can literally Google it and anybody can report when they suspect a child is being abused. They can also report anonymously. And just because somebody is part of one of these groups does not mean that they are not subject to the law. They're not above the law. There is not a religious exemption. And furthermore, sending them to church leaders for rehabilitation who give them an extra task doesn't really sound like evidence-based sex offender rehabilitation, in my opinion. But I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a mental health care provider. It's just my opinion. I'm just letting everybody know. But
yeah,
with that,
it's so true. People think in their fantasy world of what Mennonites and Amish lives are like. That why would you question a Mennonite man for backhanding a kid across the face if they're running a farmer's market? You know, they'll take care of it. And they have these visions of what life is like that are based on, you know, bacon pies and, you know, working in a wood shop. But it's not just that. It's about the control. And I think people need to, and I think through my book, I've had a lot of people come forward and just say that they now look at us differently. They look at them as, you know, maybe they need some help or maybe that child isn't as happy as I think.
Can I read a part of your book that literally made me just sit in catharsis?
Yep, go ahead.
When I shared my family history with another Mennonite woman, she shook her head and said, "You are not my kind of Mennonite." Oh boy, did I ever feel that. The simple phrase brought me such clarity about the struggles my parents and other Mennonites have had. To the public, the word Mennonite brings up visions of high-quality foods and furniture as well as homemade quilts and clothing. This image has become a marketing strategy to provide them the financial means to maintain their traditional way of life. Mennonites continue to be pilgrims to other countries until this day. They seek a place of isolation to remain devoted to the teaching of God and maintain the longevity of faith. The numerous groups and schisms that formed from the original Mennonite organization over hundreds of years signifies the changes they have made in adapting to the world around them. Each community establishes their own identities while still being bound together in similar faith. Some congregations have gone further south to Bolivia and Paraguay to achieve the utopian biblical society away from law and control and governments. Others run successful businesses of farmers markets and thrive in communities making large profits. Did you know that us Amish in the 1600s split away from the Mennonites? Because the Mennonites didn't practice shunning right, okay? Like, we're apostates. We are so not Mennonite. We would never, right?
I'm definitely with New York County Mennonite.
Oh, and you're not. Anyways. Yeah. But we're apostates, and we separated from y'all. But like that, like in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania alone, which is, I believe, the world's largest Amish community, in 1 year alone, it's estimated like $2.3 billion in tourism. And what's in Lancaster County?
I have relatives that go on bus trips there to take pictures of the Amish running around in their buggies and taking pictures of the kids coming out of the school.
Okay. Let me just throw this out there. Why are you taking pictures of kids? If it was anybody else, if you took a picture of my kid, my minor child, and put it on social media, I feel like you might be a creeper. So why is it okay to objectify Amish children like that and creep on them?
Yep. And there's such an unusual fascination. You know, there's the library near me, like they have all those Amish and Mennonite romance novels. And they can't keep them on the shelves. People are on waiting lists to read them because this is the life they think they lead, where these women are just like so pure and so lovely. And oh my gosh, they couldn't be happier than just live there making pies.
Oh, Maria.
I know.
I'm going to send you a copy of my book. You should donate it to your library.
I remember,
you can tell me where the library is. I'll donate a copy myself.
Yeah. And my book got in the library, and I've been doing lots of public speaking, and I'm actually featured right behind Miriam Taze's Women Talking for Book Club, which is excellent because we kind of tie it together in the stories we tell. Mm-hmm. Bookstores that have turned my book down that carry those Mennonite romances, because they say it's a bit controversial. We'd like to.
Oh, our lives are really controversial. Is your life really controversial? Yeah. Or is it just people maybe are being invited to sit with the discomfort and actually learn about what some old colony Mennonite children have seen and experienced?
Yeah. Well,
is your whole existence controversial too?
Hopefully not. But no, and that's the uncomfort that's within them, right? It takes a lot of courage for me to write my book and to talk about the abuse. And when I had to pen it all down, and at the time it was a story that I was making for my children, because it was an investigation into the murder trial of my father, and I wanted them to understand where they came from. And then when I started sharing it with some Mennonite women when it was first published, they would just look at me and say, you know what, this is our story. This is not just your story. This is our story, because the abuse is in all of our lives. And you have a voice that we're too afraid to have. Uh-huh. And women of all ages have come forward to me, because I thought when I published this book, I would have a lot of hate mail coming to me on any social media. And I have none. I have women that come forward and just say, you had the courage to say what no one else can say. And I'm glad it's you out there doing it, because they still don't have the courage to own their abuse or the abuse within their families.
Wow.
There was one story I should share if there's time, is about this woman who lived near me, and her mother killed herself when she was a small child in the Mennonite colony. And they were never allowed to talk about it. And her father immediately remarried because there was 10 children to care for. Uh-huh. And she read my book in November here, and she couldn't own the book because her husband wasn't allowed in the house, so she was able to worry and read it a chapter at a time. And then when the book was done, she realized, she said that it wasn't her mom's fault that she killed herself. She knew that her mom had been raped just like she was. And she got in her car in Ontario, and she made the pilgrimage all the way to northern Mexico to go and see her mother's grave for the first time. And she said, I had to let her go and know that I understood better, that it wasn't her fault that she took her life. And this is a Mexican Mennonite woman of today, you know, who still dresses in Mennonite garb, who still has generations of trauma that she's trying to work through. But those are the success stories I look for.
Yes, you will find you're so not alone.
Yeah.
When you own who you are in its entirety. And when you better understand the actual trauma that you experienced. And when you understand where you came from. But I think we're at that time where I usually ask this question. What would you say to anybody who may be experiencing similar things that you experienced and wrote about or talked about on the show today?
I think that they need to remove the shame of those events, because that's drilled into the victim that it's you that should be ashamed, and shift the blame to the right people, which can be the church, which can be the men in your life, which can be mother who allowed the abuse to go on. Shift the blame and not dwell in it. As much as, you know, I've written a book about this, I've been able to lead my own life and find joy. And that was through finding the right block about and getting the right amount of help that you need to process this, that it isn't your fault. And finding those resources is much easier in like places like Canada. In Mexico, it's slowly becoming easier for people there to reach out to, you know, Spanish authorities, where you can actually get the counseling you need to step outside your colony and your church counseling, because they can give you a different perspective that's more realistic than a religious-based perspective.
Because a religious-based perspective is not necessarily trauma-informed or even helpful for processing the trauma that's resulting in victim-blaming, shaming, and silencing, rather than giving you the space to process what you actually experienced so that you can make sense of the world after what you've experienced. And that That's journey right. can be a lifetime. It can be a lifetime journey of making sense of the world around you everywhere you go. Sometimes you might, you know, experience years of having no triggers. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, something comes up. That's your brain saying, hey, I recognize this from way back when. Because what happens is that we often experience neurological changes because of the trauma that we experience. And so trauma-informed care can help us change some of those reactions. Like Maria said, again, you, whether you experience trauma like this or whether you experience sexual violence or oppression or were part of a group like this, you are worthy of compassion and empathy and human, like human autonomy, like just human rights. You're worthy of those things. You deserve to have support and resources and, you know, community connection. We deserve to have connection, even when you don't feel like it.
Yeah.
You deserve that. And I'd like to thank you, Maria. Thank you so much. All of those things you said are so important and relevant. And I really appreciate you coming and having this coffee with me. It's lovely. I hope people buy your book even more. I really, really hope that some of the people who write about old colony Mennonites from a more privileged perspective buy your book and read it and hear. I really hope they do. I think it is important that we elevate the voices of survivors like Maria. I think it's important to support her by buying her book. I think it's important to also support her by like liking this live stream, share it, you know, comment on it, circulate it. Make sure that her voice gets heard, because this is perhaps a more realistic view of like what some old colony Mennonite children experience than maybe a movie like Women Talking, where women sit around and talk and support each other when, as we knew from Maria, that wasn't exactly the case, was it? So when we sit there and we promote Women Talking, we need to understand that it is fiction. It is fiction. This is reality. How are we responding to Maria? And if you find yourself troubled by what Maria reported about her experiences and what she has learned, I'd invite you to sit with that. Explore it. Be curious about it. What about Maria's experiences make you so uncomfortable? Is it perhaps challenging your perspective and your narrative about what it means to be a Mennonite? Because if it is, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we need to challenge that perspective, that inner dialogue that we have when we hear about experiences from various people, from various walks and ways of life. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you so much, Mary, for having me here. It's a big privilege to meet with you because I know your story, and the more voices we have, the more that we can educate.
You know, we will rise from the ashes. We will always rise from the ashes. We got this. This is how we make change. But with that being said, I'm going to say my goodbyes. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you all for your comments. Thank you to our viewers. And thank you to all of our guests. We couldn't do this without you. This podcast was funded by the Misfit Amish and our Patreon subscribers. It was produced by the Misfit Amish in 2024. Art is by BJK. Like, comment, subscribe, share. Until next time. Also, it's hosted by Mary Byler. Bis nächstes Mal.